Today's high 13, Sunday's high just 4. Right now, cloudy skies, a temperature reading of 27. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The morning show is next. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg.
Every so often, I read a work of fiction that reminds me of just what a magnificent world fiction can be. And of course, as many of you know who listen to this program regularly, I am much more apt to be reading nonfiction than fiction. And when fiction grabs hold of me, the way this particular novel has, the author has really accomplished something. And indeed, best-selling author Meredith Hall has written an absolutely spellbinding novel, which is called Beneficence. And it follows on the heels of a best-selling memoir called Without a Map. This novel, Beneficence, is set on what would appear at a glance to be an idyllic small dairy farm in Maine. But beneath the surface, and as events unfold, we see a world of rich complexity, and at certain points, wrenching tragedy as well. And with the primary characters of this book having to contend with difficult decisions and trying to come to terms with the sorrows that they never imagined would be theirs to shoulder. It's just a powerful book on so many different levels, and I'm tremendously excited to be able to speak with Meredith Hall, who has taught creative writing for a number of years in the MFA program at the University of New Hampshire. And again, this latest novel is called Beneficence. Meredith Hall, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the invitation.
I am so happy to be able to talk with you about this. I realized before we went on the air, I should have asked you, I think, a really crucial question. I'll ask it for you now, and the listeners can hear it and your answer. And namely, what is it that you feel comfortable talking about in terms of what unfolds in this novel? Because many of the events spring from an event that is shocking when we do not see it coming. So I don't know to what extent we can explore any of that. What would be your thought about that?
Well, you know, I think that you're absolutely right. This book circles this primary event that comes into this family as a terrible shock and really sends shockwaves through the family. So I think speaking about it in terms of loss and a terrible sorrow and grief that hits this family, this is an event that really knocks this family off their feet. They had always relied on their love for each other and their love for this farm. They live on this very beautiful, the dairy farm they live on in Maine is not just highly productive and very successful. It's also a very, very beautiful place. And it has been in the family of Top Center, the father and husband, for many generations. And so there's a legacy quality to this place. I think that this loss that hits this family is unexpected in many ways, because as you say, I think their life is quite, it's a kind of paradise for them. They love each other very much. They love each other well. They're very interdependent. They enjoy each other's company. They're very loyal to each other. And yet, when this sorrow hits them, when this loss hits them, they are unprepared for it. And all that love and all that connection and all the groundedness on this farm and on this land does not help them make their way through it initially. Finally, it does, but not initially.
I think you make so many really good choices, and I'm curious about many of them. One of them is that this book, I'm pretty certain, is written entirely in present tense, even though we are talking about events that were told in the chapter headings occurred a long time ago, in the 1940s into the 1950s. Yet I believe the tense is present. I'm just curious. I assume that was a conscious decision. One doesn't accidentally write in a particular tense. What were you thinking, in a sense, in making that choice? It's funny, when we usually ask, what were you thinking? It's because you made a horrible choice. I don't mean it that way. I think it's a great choice. I think it fits, but I'm not exactly sure why it fits. And I'm curious why you chose present tense.
Well, I want to say, first of all, thank you so much for the careful reading of my book. I'm very impressed. I don't know how you make your way through so many programs and keep up with all the work that's required to do that. And that you, in the middle of all that, like my book very much is really wonderful. Thank you so much. Yes, it is in present tense for a couple reasons. I made the decision that there would be several narrators. So Doris, the mother and wife, Top, the father and husband, and one of their three children, Dodie, the middle child, who's a girl, also has voice. And the story is told by each of these three members of the family in cycles: Doris, Dodie, Top, Doris, Dodie, Top. And it does happen over time. We start after World War II in the late 1940s, and move right up into the early 1960s. So there is the story in the moment is told present tense, but these people, all three of them, like their writer, they are storytellers. They love telling stories, and they, in every chance they have, they are moving into a story, something that happened once, something, small memories. These are the way that we live as families, I think, and tell these stories to each other. And they're sort of speaking to the reader and telling us about these events that happened in the past. And they signal to us that these are memories, because they will actually say, you know, it was once on a summer day, and they will move into past tense for those memory stories. The rest of it is actually told, you're absolutely right, in the moment.
And I guess that makes sense, because when we are telling stories, even if those stories are about the past, the telling of the story is in the present yes. moment, and it gives yes. it a wonderful sense of immediacy. I'm curious about something else. First of all, I love the fact that we are hearing this at different points from these three different characters. And one of the things that impresses me is that the novel retains a wonderful cohesiveness, even though each of these three figures have distinct voices and certainly distinct perspectives. Somehow these voices weave together very well, and yet they don't sound like the same person telling all of these stories and so on. It's three different distinct storytellers. I wonder how much you thought about the weaving together of these three narrative voices, and how to do that in a way that would be cohesive and at the same time give the book the wonderful variety of color and texture that it has.
Thank you for that. I think, you know, this was really an instinctive act, I think, writing this entire book. I don't work from notes, and I don't really have a plan when I write. But I do love my characters. I came to love each of these people so fully, and I came to feel that they existed somehow in this time and place, and I was getting to know them. I needed to listen to them and pay attention to them, that they were there, full and whole and complete human beings with separate lives from each other, although they were so bound by love. And for me, it really felt as if when it was Doris's time to speak, I simply moved into communication with this woman and listened carefully to what her world is and what her responses might be to it. And each of the characters really guided me. As if I paid close attention, they were already doing this story. They were already in this story. They were already experiencing these very, very large events. And the kind of love and dedication and trust that finally leads them back out of this terribly dark period, back to the love that they share for each other and the calm that they share with each other. But for me, they are very separate people, and they lived remarkably fully and remarkably alive for me as I wrote this book. Hmm.
A last question of kind of about the overarching framework. I am really intrigued by some of the choices you make in terms of which of the three characters tells a particular story, because in almost every case we're talking about stories that involve all three of the characters, and it could be any one of them that could tell that particular story. We could get it from the father's perspective or the mother's perspective or the daughter's perspective, but we never really hear about a story more than once. I mean, it's not like first we get the father's account of what happened, and then we hear how the mother saw it, and then we hear how the daughter saw it, which we sometimes will see played out in films and TV and whatever. But there's kind of a spare texture to the book in the sense that when we hear a particular story, it is from one of these characters. And I'm just curious about what you thought about in terms of choosing that this particular story is told by the father versus this particular story, which we hear told by the mother.
That's a wonderful question. When I first started imagining this book, I did think that they each would tell the same story from a different perspective. And I quickly, before I even started writing, I lost interest in that strategy. It felt static to me. It felt as if we couldn't move anywhere. Of course, we don't have the same experience as another family member. Of course, that's self-evident to me. And so if they were each going to tell their own story, I allowed them to tell the stories that were of interest to them. Top is a man, for all his flaws and for the failures of decision-making and judgment that he definitely makes, he fails his family and his own kind of moral or ethical stance. He fails that, there's no question about it. But he keeps telling us, I am a good man, and he is a good man. And so I needed to give Top a chance to prove to us, to give us evidence, to understand that he is a very good man and a deeply protective and generous-hearted man, and in many ways a selfless man, even though he ended up making some very selfish decisions. So those were the stories he wanted to tell. Doris is, before this hard event comes to them, Doris is a very, very loving and quite easygoing mother and wife. She is exceedingly hardworking on the farm and as a mother, as a homemaker. Her home is very important to her. She runs this house and this family and her part of the farm very efficiently. And yet there's always for Doris a feeling that what they are creating is fragile. She always thinks that there is some force outside what she describes as this island. There's something out there that is going to come to us. And in fact, she's right. She's absolutely right about that. A force from outside beyond her control comes in. And Tup actually believes that there's some flaw in himself that might allow tragedy or might allow something dark to happen. And he's right about that too. Dodie as a child is kind of our guide between these two parents. She's a very strong-minded, articulate and very lovable girl. I think she's really a remarkable child and grows. We watch her grow through this period of darkness in this family, absorbing much too much responsibility and ending up really having to mother her younger brother, Beston. And through all of this, I'm allowing Dodie to say, but mother and father, these are the repercussions of your actions and inactions. I'm reporting from inside the child experience. So for me, she's a valuable voice to sort of not to counter her mother and father, but to remind them of what was and what is being lost.
Right. From her, we really get a sense of the cost.
Yes.
Involve the emotional cost of what is happening in this family
experience. Yes, that's right.
Wrenching sorrow. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with bestselling author Meredith Hall about her latest book, which is a novel called Beneficence. I understand that you did not grow up on a dairy farm, but I find that hard to believe because you write with such clarity about what it is like to live on a farm and work a farm, a farm which one of the characters describes as a handsome farm, but simple. Tell us how you are able to write so vividly and with such clarity about life on the farm, if this is not something that's part of your own experience.
Well, I think first of all, we have to say that I have a very vivid imagination, and I think that's part of it. I did imagine this place very, very fully and vividly. I grew up around some animals. My sister kept sheep when I was a child and a horse. And when I was raising my own children, I chose to keep sheep and chickens, and we had big gardens. I've always lived in, I grew up in New Hampshire and have spent my entire adult life in Maine, where my family is from. And if you live in these areas, you know farm people. I've always lived in small towns, and the farms are important. They're a major part of that farm of that town community. So I've been familiar with farmers and their lives. And there was a lot that I had to research. There were many details I didn't know. I am very familiar with haying, as anybody living in these rural areas is, but I didn't know the details. I didn't know when you hay, how you know the hay is ready. I didn't know how to actually tend to calves. And so I had to do some research about castrating calves and when are calves weaned. And I needed to learn something about milk co-ops. They milk these cows and what happens to that milk. But somehow I have an uncanny feeling that I have lived this life. This is a place that feels completely and absolutely familiar to me. And I honestly can't explain why. I have a deep sense of nostalgia for this life, even though I never had this life. I never had it and lost it. So I'm not sure what that nostalgia is about. But it feels... I feel a deep longing, a deep sense of familiarity and comfort on this place. And now that the book is done, I actually miss it. I miss the house and I miss the barn and the fields and the creek and the pine hill. It's all so familiar to me. It's a place I love.
Even before this terrible tragedy befalls this family, we get a sense of the kind of the relentless tasks that sort of form the fabric of the farm and this farm family and all that needs to happen. And we realize that some people are really made for that kind of life and flourish in that kind of life. The father, Tup, at one point says, "I am made for this work and rise to it again in the morning, eager to be made tired again and again." And I suspect if you've known plenty of farmers in your life, then you've known plenty of farmers who have this sense of kind of a shared pulse. Yes. With all that must happen on a farm day. Yes. After day after day.
Yes, and each of the people in this story have a place in that work too. I think that Tup's father and grandfather and great-grandfather ran this farm. Tup grew up with his father not enjoying the farming at all. He really did not love this place. It was an obligation to him. He farmed through the Depression. And for him, the experience of that work was relentless and unforgiving. And it did not feed him literally, and didn't feed him well literally. He was not good at it, and it didn't feed his spirit in any way. So he actually saved money to send Tup away to college. He wanted to spare this first son the world that he had had, and Tup did go to college and met and married Doris. But after that first year, his father died and he was called back to the farm. He made the decision that he and his siblings would not sell the farm. He would go back and farm it. And Doris was willing. She had grown up in a town in Maine. Her father was a merchant, a small merchant. And so this was a very different life for her, very unfamiliar. But she took it on and he took it on, and it was just a perfect fit. They both found that this was exactly what they wanted to do. I think that Doris and Tup and the children are very aware of those obligations of daily work. But I also think that they were just well built, well suited to find deep satisfaction in the product of that labor, and not just the product, the process of it. And they also, I think Tup and Doris did a very good job of conveying a message that the labor of the children supported the community of the family, that their labor was vital to the well-being of the family. So Dodie works in the garden with her mother. She does a lot of canning. She does a lot of putting up of the food, and that she really takes care of the hens and the hen house. So it's a shared labor.
Right. I think one of the reasons I really love this novel so much is because, quite apart from the kind of central tragedy around which so much of this spins, there is so much else that is here as well. I mean, that it is such a rich portrait of these people, even apart from this towering tragedy that they eventually experience. And I just want to mention a couple of the details that I really love and have you say something about it. Doris, from the beginning, is a loving mother, in some ways easygoing, but also a bit overprotective, and she is the one who really wants this farm to be an island that keeps out the outer world and any of its threats. And the simplest thing, like one of Dodie's friends coming over and staying overnight, in a sense makes her uneasy and a little bit sad. You have Doris saying these intrusions felt somehow like a threat, like a crack under a door letting in an unwelcome chill. Yeah. I mean, the idea that when these friends come and stay with Dodie, that there is something intruding on this idyllic life and maybe upsetting the balance of the family and, in a sense, pulling her own daughter away from her. I think that's something, I've never been a mother nor a father, but I imagine that many, many parents at some point have had, if they're honest with themselves, have had that kind of feeling. And I just love that that's part of who Doris is. And you evidently think it's important for us to see this part of her.
Yes, she tells us at one point when this friend visits Dodie, Tup is chiding her, saying, "Leave them alone, let them play. Dodie is happy. Don't worry. And Doris says about herself, I understand that I need to allow Dodie, she's a very loving child, and I need to allow Dodie to express that love outside this family. That's very hard for Doris. She is protective of the safety of her children. She certainly is worried that there's something out there is going to do harm. But she also finds it impossible to imagine that she has to share her children with that larger world. They live a long way from town, and that suits Doris very nicely. She is happiest when they are a family of five, the three children and her husband and herself, away from the world. She loves that long, long road separates her and her family from that road, from that town.
You also tell us, although it is through the words of her husband, Tup, that Doris, because she is not from that community originally, does not perfectly fit. Although by no means is she an outsider in the sense of being treated unkindly, but nevertheless, there is this slight sense of emotional distance. Tup says, Doris is not from here. Doris is from away, and no one in this town ever forgets that. And I suspect that's maybe not quite so true nowadays in small town America, but I suspect back in 1947 or 1948, that was probably an inescapable reality for just about anybody who finds themselves living in a small town that they're not from.
Yes, I actually think that this is still a fact of life in many rural towns in Maine. Tup was a very appealing man, and certainly would have been a catch for any of the other young women his age as he was growing up. And instead, he went outside and brought a wife in from away. And there is a sense for both of them that Doris is well-liked, she's respected, she's pretty, she takes good care of herself. When they go into town, she puts on a dress, and they go to church affairs, you know, a Halloween fair or a dance. And she shows well, she presents herself well, and Tup is very proud of her. But they are both very aware that the townspeople who are kindly toward her and respectful toward her will never actually see her as a member of the community. It is interesting, though, they both get a lesson as they finally emerge from this very dark time. One of the moments that marks that reemergence is that they are back in the public again. They do go to town, and they're around people that they know. And Doris is quite shocked to see the genuine warmth that is extended to her. There is the community understands the depth of this loss, the tragedy that has hit them, and the struggle that both Doris and Tup have had to make their way out beyond that tragedy. And the town is very accepting of that. Tup and Doris have not behaved very well. And instead of being judged for that, in the end, even this woman from away has been released from judgment. And the town it feels great compassion for them. And I think that Doris learns something about the quality of the affection that the town feels for her.
Another thing I really appreciate about this novel is the rich complexity of these characters. I mean, at least in a way. In some ways, these seem like simple people in the very best sense of that word. I don't mean simple-minded or simplistic, but just good, ordinary, salt-of-the-earth people in many respects, and yet beneath the surface are other layers that are just fascinating. I think you bring this to life so well in the character of Tup in a scene early in the novel, pre-tragedy, if you will, when the family is out ice skating. And at one point, Tup, the father, goes skating off on the river all by himself. Do you mind if I just read this passage?
I would love that.
So he is gone, and hears in the distance his daughter Dodie's calling, but he skates forward. I went forward and I was alone. Soosh, 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 soosh. The sun was ahead of me. Nothing was behind me. There were no needs and no expectations and nothing waiting for me. The river curved right and left and farther right, a ribbon laid here for me alone. A crow called from the top of a towering old stave oak, and the sun shone purple against him. I did not rush, taking the river as mine, the silence as mine, the emancipating light as mine, my legs strong and the cold air now stinging my lungs, all mine, with nothing secluding me or hindering me or binding me. And so I did not stop. So here is this man who the world thinks of probably in no other way except a good, hardworking farmer who loves his farm. And yet there is this other side to him that is completely unknown to the world and really unknown to us until we come across this passage. Just tell us what it's like to kind of fashion these other facets of a given character.
That was wonderful to hear you read that. Thank you very much. I really enjoyed that. I think that this is a warning to us as readers and to Tuck himself that none of us are selfless. And no matter how dedicated we are to the people that we love and to our obligations to a good life, the life that we believe that we want to live and should live, in spite of that, we all, I think, own some part of this desire to be free of obligation and to be free of hindrance, to be free of duty, even if these are duties that we choose. They are part of the life we love. There was something about that moment, the landscape of a river winding out. He says, he tells us he has no patience with skating on a pond, which has edges all around. He loves this river. And I think there's something about that river that says to him, I can for this moment escape. Of course, when he does finally come back, he finds his family cold. He has the keys to the truck. Their fire has gone out. The children's feet are freezing. And Doris doesn't say anything, but he understands that he has claimed something he had no right to claim. And it cost the family. And it's a kind of presaging of events that are going to come to them.
We're speaking with Meredith Hall, and we're talking about her most recent book, a wonderful novel called Beneficence. We are not going to identify the terrible tragedy that befalls this family, but we will talk about the ways in which you treat this in your book. One of the choices you make that I think is very intriguing is that just at a glance, we know that something has happened just in the way the words appear on the page at the start of part two, which is called During, which chronicles the events in the immediate aftermath of this tragedy. Suddenly, the pages look, in a sense, broken with very, very short bits of text separated by space and then another short little burst. I mean, nothing like what the book appeared before that. Tell us more about this conscious choice.
This is a wonderful reading you've given this book. I really appreciate it. Doris is the one who breaks the news to us that this terrible thing has happened. And she quite literally cannot actually say, this is what happened. She can't even name it. She tells us from the start that she really doesn't even have a clear grasp of what happens in those first days. She is unable to narrate these events to us. I think that we all I think we all know sorrow. We've all experienced sorrow. We've all experienced loss. This is a particularly terrible and dramatic loss for this family. It's a terrible incident. But I think all of us understand what grief and loss can do to us. And I think these characters are saying, really are calling out to us and saying, you will understand what I'm trying to tell you because you have known this kind of loss too. I think the fracturing of our days, the fracturing of our sleep, the fracturing of our connections with the people that we love, sorrow is really a kind of solo journey. And these characters struggle through their days and struggle with the reader to express the depth of that loss. And I think that's quite human. I think that is how we experience loss.
Right. And it's interesting too that we hear much less from Doris for a time in the heart of this book, because she is, in a sense, and I think she maybe even says this or others say this, that she is sort of lost to herself, lost from herself, withdrawn into this kind of vortex of sorrow from which she just doesn't know how to emerge. One really kind of haunting theme through this part of the book is at several different points when Cup tells his wife, it's time. And in his mind, it's time for her to do something or other for the very first time, something which she finds unbearably difficult, but in his mind, it's time. Every time I read those two words, I just thought about all of the people who have said those same words, meaning well, and maybe in some cases, it's words that need to be spoken. I mean, as I read those words in your book, my immediate reaction was not, oh, don't say that. I understood where those words were coming from. But there's so much wrapped up in those two words. Tell us more about this theme as this family tries to come to grips with this tragedy.
Yes, Pop is quite constant in coming to Doris and saying, you are not responsible for this. I don't blame you. You are not guilty of this. But you do have obligations to me and especially to these children. And He tries again and again to call her back to some semblance of normal days. And Doris is unable to do that. She just simply is not able to transcend these events. He wants very much for her to visit the grave. And he tells her again and again, it's time, will you come with me? And she says, no, I just can't do that. So there is this, I don't think that Tup ever means to pressure her, but he definitely is feeling that the children are suffering and that he is suffering and that Doris herself is suffering. Doris's this loss of herself, this going into herself that she does, lasts a very long time. And her journey back out of that very, very dark universe is slow. I think now we would call it a very profound depression caused by grief. At the time, I don't think those concepts were available to them. Tup does ask her several times, and his sister May comes to help Doris with household chores and to take care of the children. And both of them suggest that she see a doctor, and that doesn't ever happen. I think that that's just beyond anybody's real ability to enact.
One of the things we read of is that what keeps this family moving forward is what at one point someone calls the rescue of order. What we were talking about earlier, that on a farm, there are certain things that must continue to happen. And that's what sort of keeps the wheels spinning. And it also, in a sense, I suppose, allows these characters, in a sense, to evade some of the more difficult truths about what they are experiencing. You at certain points have Doris able to do some things and unable to do other things. And I like the sort of unevenness of her grief. I mean, it's not that, I mean, I suppose for a brief time, she's completely incapable of really doing anything, but then slowly at least can begin to walk around and can slowly begin to do some things, but only certain things, and other things are beyond her capacity. Can you just say a word about shaping Doris's grief and the way it manifests itself in such an authentic way?
Yes, Doris, interestingly, is able to cook for the family. She, you know, after this initial shock, she manages to fulfill her obligations as far as cooking. She provides food for the family, but she is not able to do any of the other work. She doesn't work in the garden. She doesn't keep the house clean, except that she obsessively clears shelves and drawers and closets again and again and again. That goes on for a long time. Top and Dodie has had to pick up all of Doris's household work, and increasingly the gardening, and actually raising their food. And Doris is chided by her husband and her child again and again, saying, but you already did those shelves. You already cleaned the closet. But she cannot do the work that is required. I think that that cooking for her family is almost a brainstem activity for her. I think it's quite a primitive and innate activity for her. Beyond that, she just cannot function. We spend a lot of time listening to Dodie take on these responsibilities, and her sense of confusion and slowly her growing sense of resentment that she is having to do so much. But when Top finally comes to her and says, this is impossible without your mother's labor, you know, every farm needs a farm wife. And without a wife here, I can't do this alone. And Dodie steps forward and says, I will be that farm wife. And she does. She's in school. She's an excellent student, but she also fulfills almost all of Doris's chores, all of her work, all of her part of running this farm and running this family. And Dodie is quite resentful of it. She becomes resentful and angry at Top for his failures and at Doris for her failures.
Right. And at one point where this really becomes sad is when Doris emerges enough from her vortex to see more clearly what's going on. And in a sense, how she is failing her children and failing her husband. I mean, that's how she herself sees it. And yet is powerless to, in a sense, rise above it. At one point, she is thinking to herself, I watch myself. I am not who I am. I am not a wife. I am not a mother. I want to be. I mean, she sees herself failing in these roles that once meant so much to her. And I think you are giving us such a perceptive look at what it means to be caught in this kind of depression, where even when you know that you're depressed, when part of you knows that something is not right and you need help, that doesn't mean you're in a place where you can seek that help or even receive that help.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right about that. And I also believe that, I don't think that we generally in our culture allow enough time for grief. I think that we're pretty impatient of grief. We expect people to rise above it and heal from it very quickly. And Doris just is not able to do that. She, you know, as we move into the last parts of this book, as this family finds its way back to the beneficence that really is at the heart of this story, Doris and Top both are left with great regret because they do understand their failures, and they forgive each other for those failures, but those failures have changed this family and changed them. The whole story of this loss and this sorrow has marked this family, and they are very aware once they finally heal enough to really become a family, a very, very profoundly successful move towards being a family again and being a farm family again, still they have to reckon with those inadequacies and the things. I think that Top believed that he would be more heroic than he was. He believed in his ability to behave exactly right for his family. And he's quite shocked that he also has not been able to do that.
Right. And early on in the book, he expresses some concern that one of his greatest fears in life would be to do something that he would end up terribly regretting.
And yes,
that ultimately is what happens. I also love a very simple little moment in which Tup, I mean, just at his wit's end in terms of how to continue to move forward, decides to take a job someplace else. I mean, a factory job in the evening, in addition, of course, to all he does on the farm. And in consecutive sentences, you have Tup thinking to himself, I want to do this. I do not want to do this. And, yeah. I mean, it could not be more stark on the page, this idea that sometimes we do things that we want to do that we do not want to do. And yes, it just points to the complexity of the human condition, especially when it's reeling from such a tragedy.
Yes, I think Tup is telling us in that section, excuse me, that he needs escape. He needs to rescue himself from what is going on at home. He cannot keep doing what he's been doing, but he also does not want to make this move. He becomes a kind of mechanic for all of the equipment in textile mill nearby, working nights, taking care of all of the equipment. And he enjoys the sort of black and white mechanism. It works or it doesn't work. I fix it or I don't fix it. And that's a great comfort to him, to be among those machines and to keep them running well. But he also knows, and he returns every morning to the farm at early in the morning, at dawn. He is there to do the work of the farm too. His children, Dodie, is very resentful of him going off at night and having this job. He understands that, and he still cannot say no to it.
Right. One of the things he loves about that mill is everything can be fixed. Here, unlike his home. In our last minute, I want you to explain three Latin words that Tup taught to his children, dum, spiro, spero, and why they are so important in this book.
These words speak about hope. They speak about our ability to dream and believe and move towards those dreams and our hopes. And Tup has taught his children that they are built for a love of life and a fullness of life and a belief in themselves and in their hopes and dreams in life. So Tup has modeled for them and actually expresses to them that they are, that this is going to be inevitably a part of them. Hmm.
Dum spiro spero, while I breathe, I hope. The novel again is titled Beneficence. It is published by David R. Godin Publishing and the author Meredith Hall. Meredith Hall, what a pleasure to read your marvelous book and to have this time to speak with you about it on The Morning Show. I thank you so much and wish you well.
Thank you very much. That was really a wonderful conversation. I enjoyed it completely.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, a newly recorded follow-up conversation with Richard Stein and Raymond Clark, who are part of the law enforcement training program here at Gateway Technical College. On Thursday, a legend among public radio listeners, Diane Rehm, talking about her latest book, which explores the practice of medical aid in dying. On Friday, out of the archives, a memorable conversation with a former Carthage faculty colleague of mine, Wayne Thompson, talking about racism in America. The time is exactly